The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Allison Green. Allison is the creator and writer for the Ask a Manager website, which receives over 2 million visits each month and has been recognized as a Forbes Most Influential Career Site and has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Marketplace Money, and a host of other media. She writes weekly columns for U.S. News and World Report, Fast Company, and Inc. She is the co-author of Managing to Change the World and the author of How to Get a Job, Secrets of a Hiring Manager. And she previously worked as a chief of staff for a multi-million-dollar national lobbying group. Allison, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Hey, Kelly. Thanks so much for having me.
So I've been all over your website for the last couple of weeks, and it's actually both a helpful and cathartic resource. You dispense great advice, and you bring up so many issues that don't get talked about on a day-to-day basis, but are absolutely game changers to a happy and productive workplace. So, and you can tell me whether I got this right or wrong. If I had to sum up your general point of view, your POV, it's this. You dispense radical and aggressive common sense.
I think that is right, actually. That's kind of my secret. And if that gets out, I'll have nothing more to write about.
Yeah. Don't tell anyone if you want to hold on to that. So I was looking at who your influences were, and if you had an especially great boss who you got wisdom from by their great example. And then I saw you write this. You wrote, "What I had instead were anti-mentors, bosses who were so bad that they unwittingly formed the start of my thinking on management by providing a perfect model of what not to do."
That is right. You know, when I wrote that, the site was much smaller. I worry now that some of those bosses who I'm talking about in that piece may have seen it, but I stand by it. It's definitely true. I mean, having a boss can be a pretty miserable experience, but right. The silver lining is that it's such a learning experience about what doesn't work and why and what the impact is on your staff and on the results that you're getting when you're managing poorly.
Right. What kind of bad boss behavior did you have to deal with?
Oh, gosh. Probably the most common was the sort of learned helplessness, checked out boss, people who really didn't want to manage. Like, I had one manager, now that I think about it, who actually openly would tell our team that she hadn't wanted the promotion to manager. She had taken it begrudgingly. And it really played out that way. She just sort of chose to not manage to the extent that it was possible for her to make that choice. So things didn't get done. Work didn't get delegated. Problems didn't get addressed and resolved. Things just kind of festered to the point that some of my coworkers and I would devise elaborate systems to sort of get things done despite our boss rather than
right.
because of her. And I think that's really common, actually. I think a lot of times we'll end up in management jobs because it's the logical next step in their career. And this is a huge fault of the way that we deal with employment. That we don't give people a lot of paths to move up that don't involve managing people. So if you want to move up in a lot of careers, that is what you're going to end up doing. But it's not, you have to really want to manage and enjoy it to do it well. It's not a job where you can just kind of give it the bare minimum and have things go well.
Well, right. And the thing that you hit upon, which is like people don't have any practice in this. You know, almost everyone who becomes a manager, it happened to me, right? When I took over Second City, I'd like hardly led any teams. And one of the reasons, I mean, a lot of people wonder why Second City is in the business space. But in part, it's because we've got this model of practice, and our bosses, like in the theater, are the director. And there's all these sort of the whole education process that goes to the director being in the position of then leading the people. And to what you sort of identified as a bad boss behavior, the one thing that director needs to show vulnerability, but also that they want to be there. And they want to participate. And if you have a boss who you know, is all vulnerability and no, you know, wanting to be there, that screws everything up.
Absolutely. And I think it's really common, especially in nonprofits where I come from, that people get moved into management jobs because they're really good at something else. They were good at fundraising, or they were good at organizing or communications. So they get promoted and they get moved into managing other people, but the skills that it takes to get that stuff done through other people is often totally different than the skills that it took to get it done on your own. So no one, there's very little training, and you tend to get thrown in and you're sort of expected to figure it out by trial and error, sometimes much more error.
And it can, I mean, there's
it's certainly not the only job that's like that, but it's one where you can really have a pretty significant impact on a whole bunch of people who are working under you.
Right. So if you can learn from bad bosses, can you learn from bad employees?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think a lot of the things that I feel particularly strongly about that managers should do are for me, messing them up myself as a manager. I mean, the first time I had to fire someone, we ended up getting sued.
That'll do it. It was my fault.
And I mean, we won. We hadn't actually done anything illegal. But what happened was and this is very common with managers, especially newer managers, I was so hesitant to talk to this person about his performance problems that I didn't say enough. I didn't want to be mean, and I didn't want to hurt his feelings, and
right.
So I shied away from having really hard conversations with him about the problems in his work. And when it got to the point that we really did need to let him go, we couldn't let it go any longer, I hadn't done that groundwork of preparing him to know that that was coming. And when you handle a firing that way, you sort of set it up for the person to think, well, I don't think my work was that bad. There must be some other reason for this. And they go looking for one, and they think, well, is it for some illegal reason? In this case, he had a medical condition, and he ended up alleging that it's because of that. And that was 100% my fault. I hadn't been clear with him. And so I learned from that, like, you have to be clear. You have to have hard, difficult, awkward conversations, and you have to do it early. You can't wait until it's such a problem that you're already thinking about letting the person go.
Well, we have feedback completely wrong. I mean, it is in corporate America, the performance review is probably the most broken thing that exists. We had a couple of behavioral scientists in the office yesterday talking about this very thing. And they said, among other things, that all the data that they've got is that performance reviews don't work, if you try to do what's called a compliment sandwich, right, good note, criticism, good note at the end, that doesn't work. And they said they have the data on anonymous feedback, and the data on that is that you don't get truthful feedback, you get more negative feedback. And I think what we do at Second City actually is a very healthy way of doing feedback, because it's sort of that feedback 360 thing, right? So when we're working with performers and writing a show, there's all kinds of rules for giving notes and taking notes and having people just listen to things and act on things and try other things out, and that you're in constant dialogue so that there really can't be a surprise at the end of the year because no one said anything to you.
Yeah, that's the big problem with the way performance reviews are usually done, is that it's like, here's your one time during the course of the year to talk about how things are going, first of all, you don't want to save issues up because they fester, and people are frustrated when they're hearing in December about something they did wrong in February, and they could have been doing it correctly this whole time. And it shouldn't be a once-a-year conversation. I mean, feedback and talking about how things are going, that's like the essence of communicating with your employee and conversely with your manager. It's crazy to save it up for once a year.
Yeah.
I think performance reviews can be useful if they are done in the right context. mm-hmm. they're done in a context where you do have regular ongoing feedback and you've normalized this thing about regular
yes.
feedback. So it's not a big scary thing where, like,
yes.
you know, you go into the conference room and close the door and there's a box of Kleenex on the conference room table because you might cry. You know, it shouldn't be that. It should be a regular ongoing normal thing. And then you can use your performance review at the end of the year to talk about sort of big picture. Let's step back and reflect.
Totally.
Is there a development we need to do? What are your upcoming goals? That kind of thing. But it shouldn't be like, this is our big feedback conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I love the idea of the Kleenex box there. Like, what are you signaling? I mean, it's like,
yeah.
this is going to be terrible. In your book, Managing to Change the World, you write that most managers need to be more hands-on than they are, but also more hands-off.
Yeah. So
explain
that.
That.
Confusing when you first hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So my co-author, Jerry Hauser, and
yeah.
I, what we've seen a lot of is managers who just kind of get the balance wrong. They get really into the weeds, like really nitpicky on details, but they're not setting clear expectations up front about the big outcomes that
mm-hmm.
they're going for. So you get employees who are really frustrated because they feel like their manager isn't giving them like really clear big picture goals, but on the other hand is like hovering in inappropriate ways. And you get managers who are frustrated because they feel like, I told you how I wanted it. Why isn't it coming back to me that way? So what we say is that the thing that you really want to spend a lot of time investing in is really talking to people about what the outcome that you're going for is. What does a successful performance in this role look like? And then give people room to figure out how to get there. You don't need mm-hmm. to dictate how they do it every step of the way. You just need to make sure that you're on the same page about what it looks like at the end.
Yeah, there's a phrase that I love, hands-on delegation, which speaks exactly to that, right? You need to do both. You need to be big picture, and you need to give people room to fail, room to try, room to practice.
Yeah, and you know, if you don't do that, you're giving up a huge part of the power of having a staff of people working for you. I mean, if you're just dictating everything and
yep.
having them execute the activities that you've decided on, you're going to accomplish so much less than if you actually let them be creative and think about how to achieve these goals. And I mean, you probably don't have all the ideas. They probably
yeah.
have their own. And if you give them room to be able to think and be creative and figure out the best path to a goal, you're, you know, instead of just having your brain control everything, you're going to have a whole team of brains, and that is pretty much always better.
Yeah, totally. And one of the things I love is that in your book, you don't just say delegate. You actually you frame components around good delegation. And the three you cite are agree on expectations, stay engaged, and create accountability and learning. I love that because it's not just accountability. It's accountability and learning.
That's right. And I think, I mean, I'm guilty of this too. I mean, people are busy, and in the rush of day-to-day work, it's really easy to rush through a conversation where you're delegating an assignment or not come back to it afterward and close the loop and talk about how things went and what lessons
yeah.
you can take forward for the next time. I mean, I get that. I fall into that trap. It's normal.
Sure.
But if you want to manage well in the long term, I think you've got to commit to carving out the time to do those things because that is how people get better and better at what they do.
Yeah, totally. I mentioned that the director in the Second City process is kind of the manager of at the time. And one of our legendary directors is a guy named Mick Napier, who founded the Annoyance Theater. And he actually created a workshop for us around how directors and producers can work more effectively together. And I wanted to read this thing that he wrote because it was around the need to be right. And Mick writes, you need to be discreet about words. If a producer holds important the need to always be right, they are probably operating out of fear, the fear of not being competent, the fear of not having function, the fear of not having respect. And if you can show the director and the cast that you are fallible, trust increases. That's not saying that you're sorry all the time. It's just that the syntax of not having to be right about everything.
I love that.
Right?
And I think that need to be right leads to so many different kinds of bad behavior. I mean, one is not giving people freedom to do their jobs well. And I think it also leads to sort of like jerky managers who don't really trust that they can manage effectively if they back off. So they feel like they have to have a style that's really heavily based around fear and control.
Yeah.
And I think it stems from the same thing.
Yeah, it's all fear-based. And we see that time and time again. I mean, you know, in an improv context, when people are having to sort of make it up, we see the way fear-based behavior makes for bad comedy, which is the exact same thing in the office, right? It's you know, people not trusting the other person. It's people, you know, cheating and taking other people's lines. You know, there's all these sort of, you know, bad behaviors that all stem from fear. And it feels like the best managers figure out ways to eradicate fear from the day-to-day workplace.
I think that's true. And I have to ask you, does that happen? People take other people's lines?
Yeah. So what happens with sort of fear-based improvisation is they will start matching what other people are saying. They'll just say the same thing because they're so in their head. They think they've got nothing up there, and they're not trusting the person across from them to help them out of the jam. And you see it sort of I see that stuff happen in the office, too.
That makes a lot of sense. Improv, really, I mean, it's like to do it well, I imagine, it's the ultimate in casting off your fear and just trusting that it'll be okay.
Yeah, that is, I think when you take like the level A class, really that is a class in getting you to be okay looking foolish, to forget your fear. And then they've done scientific research, and they did this with both rappers and jazz musicians, that when they are improvising, those artists, the part of their brain that self-censors goes down. And the part of the brain that allows you to create goes up, which makes perfect sense. But that's a much better space to create in. And you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about the falseness of the lone creative. Everyone wants to make it like it's magic unicorns back in the room making this stuff up because it keeps people wealthy and separate. When everyone has creativity, and tapping that in your employees is not so much sort of saying that, you know, they have something special. It's no, they got to just take away the fear.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you cannot do it if you're a manager who has a really tight control style. People will be afraid of the consequences if they mess up, and just you can't make it work.
Right. And
it goes back to you're just not going to get the same results.
Yeah. And you know, I speak on this stuff at various, you know, functions, and people are like, well, my boss, you know, is this and terrible and doesn't do that. What should I do? And I am kind of forced at that point to say quit.
Yeah. Sometimes, right. You know, it's funny. I noticed maybe a year ago. So I've been running Ask a Manager for 9 years. So it took me 8 years to realize that I was pretty quick to say, people would write in. I mean, people just have horrific stories about their workplaces and their bosses. And I think pretty quick traditionally to say, you're going to be able to fix this. You probably should leave.
Yeah.
And about a year ago, I started feeling like I need a better answer than that. I mean, often that really is the answer. If things are egregious enough, that might just be the answer. You can't fix everything. But I've tried to be, in the last year, more cognizant of sometimes being able to leave a job, at least any time in the near term, is a luxury.
Yeah.
Your finances might not allow it, or you might not be in an in-demand field, or you might be in a terrible geographic area for work. And so I've been trying to be better about saying, like, to fix this in any permanent sense, people have to leave. But here's what you can do meanwhile. That said, it's hard. I mean, usually the stuff that you can do meanwhile is really about adjusting your own mindset.
Right.
You know, there's no wand to wave to make the manager into a different person.
Yeah, coping mechanisms. Hey, can I ask you about the hugging lady?
Please.
So, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Of course.
Okay, so you said this was one of your favorite, you know, letters, and I'm going to let you explain what the letter was because it's awesome.
It is awesome. So I got a letter from someone who was writing in about the receptionist in their office who was sort of aggressively hugging pretty much everyone, other employees in the office, visitors to the office. I think even visitors who weren't there to see her. They had a lot of partner organizations who would send people over to meet with them, and they would all get hugs. And the person writing in said it was pretty clear to her that not everyone was comfortable. And these weren't just casual hugs. These were like full body
real good hugs.
Yeah, like I think she said she would like make noises of pleasure during some of them. I mean, it just sounded like an intense hugging situation.
Uh-huh.
I loved this letter because I am not a hugger with people who I don't know. Frankly,
nope.
With a lot of people who I do know. Like, I'm just not into it. I'm definitely not into it at work.
Yep.
So, I mean, I was filled with horror on reading this letter, but also excitement because this is like my favorite type of thing to answer. So I believe, if I'm recalling it correctly, I told her, like, you're just going to have to sit down and tell her very clearly, not everyone is comfortable with this. You can't always judge who is. I mean, one of the problems with this type of behavior is that people think, like, well, I can tell if it's welcome or not. I'm good at judging it. But almost by definition with this, people are terrible judges of it.
Totally.
If you're a hugger yourself, you tend to default to assuming other people like it too.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her she had to sit down and have the conversation with her. Now, there was an update to this letter.
Oh, do tell.
Well, now I can't remember what it was. I'm gonna
Got
it. She did have the conversation tonight, but I think she had to have it twice before it stopped for good.
That makes sense.
This is another one where, like, people believe, like, this is warm and friendly behavior, so don't take it too seriously when they're told people don't like it.
Yeah.
I mean, really, as a general rule, if someone tells you to stop touching someone else, you should take it very seriously. I think men generally know that at least that's what society wants of them. I think women sometimes take it less seriously because it's not considered as, like, pervy if it's women. Maybe why she didn't take it so seriously the first time. But yeah, I just, the mental image that the letter gave me of this receptionist aggressively running up to visitors and hugging them while moaning was, I mean, it will live on with me forever.
Oh, so funny. And I think your point of people not knowing their own behaviors, it's that perspective concept in psychology, right? Which is, if I'm running a red light, it's because I need to get somewhere in a hurry. If you're running a red light, it's because you have road rage.
Yes. Exactly. David Foster Wallace has a great essay that has always stayed with me where he talks about when you've had a bad day and you have to go by the grocery store on your way home and you're just filled with rage at the people who you see doing frustrating things. The person in line ahead of you is taking forever, mm-hmm. digging coupons out of her wallet one by one. And he talks about all the things that those people could be going through. Like, she could have just said her father has cancer. She could have just said that she has cancer. And how it just changes your perspective on people. I don't know how I got off on this tangent.
No, it's great. I love him. It's how to behave also, I mean, it's generational, right? I remember early days Second City box office. So this is like 1989 to 91 or whatever. You know, everyone called each other hun. A lot of back rubs. I'm sure it was just thoroughly inappropriate. But times change, and there are new rules, and you have to sort of adapt with it. I don't know that there's any other way.
Yeah, I think that's right. A lot of back rubs. Interesting.
I know. Well, it's a theater, right? We're way more huggy, probably, than most businesses. But I get your point.
So do you see people who haven't really picked up on that change and it's kind of standing out as not being appropriate anymore?
Yes. I totally see it because at Second City, we basically develop young talent. So, like, the top actors at Second City are always like 28, but the rest of us are getting older. And so for the great aspect of that, for those of us who are lifetime learners, is that we pick up on not only the great new music to listen to, but also on these great new enlightened behaviors. But there's not always people who are reading the room like that. And so there's sort of this awkward re-education process that really, I think, is probably now coming to a head because it's so much more serious in the workplace and we see what's going on in society and microaggressions and all that stuff, right? So times have changed and there's some people that do have trouble changing with the times.
Yeah. This comes up in letters to ask a manager a lot, like someone behaving in a way that is just kind of feeling creepy to other people and no one wants to say anything because it's such an awkward conversation. But really, if that person is essentially a nice person who means well, they would want you to give them a heads up. They're making other people uncomfortable. And if they're not a nice person who would want to know that, then, I mean, all the more reason to have a very straightforward conversation with them.
Sure, and they might be off their meds. I mean, honestly, it's that's the other thing. I want to ask you about your not-to-do list.
Yes. So everyone has to-do lists, or at least knows about to-do lists. I wrote a piece talking about how you should also have a not-to-do list of things that you've deliberately and strategically decided that you won't spend time on.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that is I see people, I mean, everyone feels in a work context, like they never have enough time to get to everything that they want to get done. But often they're spending not insignificant amounts of time on things that aren't actually connected to their biggest priorities, but they're doing it because it's right in front of them, or it's easy to do, or it just feels like it'll be annoying to have it hanging over them. So I feel like people need to be really, really deliberate about thinking through, this is the stuff that I've determined doesn't make sense for me to spend time on relative to other priorities. It's
right.
Not that it doesn't have any intrinsic worth of its own, but when I compare it to everything that's on my plate, it's not the highest priority stuff, and so I'm going to deliberately not do it. I think it's so hard for people to do. I see especially managers get pulled in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. You can come in on Monday thinking like, okay, my biggest priorities this week are A, B, and C, and then it's Friday and you haven't done any work on any of them and you
right.
don't know where the time went. A not to-do list, I think, will help.
Totally. I mean, scarcity is a issue that behavioral science has taught us is huge in how people make bad choices because they simply don't have the capacity or the time. And if, you know, and if you and I are feeling overwhelmed, and I imagine our resources are significantly better than the rest of the world, just imagine how someone who's in a very low income or dangerous situation is behaving at the office. It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. I think there's a little bit of like magical thinking in there too, that like somehow I can just find a way to get it all done.
Yeah, totally.
If you sit down and you look at like how much time you actually have in a day, there's no way you could get it all done. But people want to feel like they can.
Yeah. So we're coming close to the end, but I want to squeeze in another question before I ask you for your yes and story, which I'm sure you've been sweating about. Everyone does. You wrote a thing about what hiring managers wish you knew. And I thought this was kind of awesome because there's, you know, that interview experience. I think we have an idea of the way it should go. And there's a zig. But actually, I think you present a zag to it. And I three of them I wrote down because I really liked them. One was we pay attention to the small stuff. One was we need to know your real weakness. And the third was you can be too early for an interview.
Yes.
So how too early is too early for an interview?
More than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people get this wrong because everyone hears over and over, don't be late, don't be late. So they get there really early,
yeah.
which is great. Like, be on the safe side. But don't go into the office. Go to
right.
a coffee shop, wait
right.
in your car. If you show more than 10 minutes early, it's almost, I mean, I don't want to say rude, but it's kind of thoughtless. Because
yes.
now I'm sitting in my office having to figure out, do I need to come out and greet you, but I'm in the middle of this other thing? Are you expecting me to start early? I feel guilty about leaving you just sitting there. But we had a time schedule, so let's
right.
take the time.
My wife, if she's listening to this, is laughing because, like, we are the couple, and it's my fault, that is waiting in the car for 15 minutes because I need to be early everywhere.
I need to, I mean, I'm neurotic about being early ever, but like you probably wouldn't, I mean, hopefully wouldn't show up at
nope.
like a private house for a party
nope.
and knock on the door 15 minutes early.
Nope. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, like I wait till like 1 minute before and I'm like, I think we're okay now. but if it's a meeting, I use that 10 minute rule. I'm probably more like a 7 or 6 minute rule, but I make sure like I'm at the Starbucks next door. Yeah, it's because I'm just so paranoid about being late.
I am too. I actually think like it's a pathology in me. But you're managing it appropriately so that other people don't have to carry the burden of.
Thank you. I needed the validation. All right. So the way we end all these podcasts, because the show is called Getting to Yes and Yes And is the improv tenet around affirming and contributing and building something with other people in opposite to no. And most of us live lives where we say no most of the time. And I'm curious if you have an experience either at work or in your life where you might have said yes and instead of no, or no instead of yes and what the results were.
Okay, so after you gave me a heads up that you were going to ask this, I spent some time thinking about this. And first I had like a horrifying period where I thought, oh my God, I've never said yes and to anything. But then I realized, actually, there's a very, very literal example from
right.
my personal life. So I should say in advance, this story does not make me look very good.
Okay.
Okay, so my husband and I come from families and backgrounds with different conversational styles. My family is all East Coast Jews.
Yep.
We say what we think. We don't have a lot of filter. We argue, we interrupt, we disagree with vigor. I also worked for years in political advocacy, which attracts lots of strong personalities mm-hmm. who are pretty pushy about their opinions. My husband comes from a much more diplomatic tradition, and I think it was pretty jarring to him for the first couple of years of our relationship when he would float an idea or a theory, and I would sort of shoot it down without realizing that that's what I was doing, just because because I thought debate was interesting and fun, and I assumed that he would too, and I assumed if he disagreed with my disagreement, he would push back, and that would be a fun dialogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my family, that is a fun dialogue. We find it very fulfilling, but apparently not everyone functions that way.
Right.
So, I should say, I do realize this makes me sound like a horrible partner and makes him sound like a long-suffering saint, but I promise that I really am nice to him.
Uh-huh.
I just did not realize how this was coming across.
Right.
But eventually I started to understand that the way that I was going into those conversations was feeling to him like a conversation ender.
Mm-hmm.
That he was hearing it as me just shooting down all of his ideas. So I've tried to be really deliberate about reframing the way that I approach those things. And really, it's yes and, quite literally.
Yeah.
So I found, like, I can actually continue to disagree with him if I just frame it differently. And if I start by saying yes to something in what he's saying, to put this in concrete terms, he's a writer, and he likes to tell me about interesting plots that he's dreamed up.
Yes.
I am practical and annoying. So I used to start by telling him all the reasons why plot point X would not make any sense in real life,
mm-hmm.
which was not what he was looking for. So I learned how to start saying, yes, that's really interesting. And I think it would be fun to figure out how you would approach plot point X.
Yes.
Which to him is a more satisfying conversation than me being a naysayer. And we both get what we want.
You've nailed yes and. That's exactly what it is.
It's yes. And I didn't realize it until I was thinking over at your request.
Oh, that's so funny because I think, you know, a lot of people, especially business people, their eyes glass over, you know, when we talk about yes and, because they're like, oh, it's going to waste so much time. And it's like, no. This is the best way to get to know, because what you've done is you've affirmed what the person across from you has to say. You've built it into maybe something a little bit different. And then if it doesn't work, it kind of doesn't matter at the end of the day because everyone's feeling okay about the conversation.
Yeah, he's getting exactly what he wants.
And so are you.
Feel like, yeah, and so am I. I still get to raise my issue that I have, but it's happening in a much nicer way, and he doesn't feel like I'm just saying no to his thoughts.
You nailed this story.
Yay, I'm so glad.
Allison Green, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down, working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
This is Second City Works, getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.